on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 90-year-old Neil Green of Oakland, California, originally from Columbus, Kansas. He served on Navy destroyers from before Pearl Harbor all the way through the end of the war. A little background on his two ships. We heard a bit about the first one. It was a World War I era destroyer called the USS Goff. It actually helped escort Charles Lindbergh back from his legendary transatlantic flight in 1927, long before Neil got aboard. You heard him describe the events of November 1943, when a sister ship, the USS Bory, rammed and sank a German U-boat in the Atlantic. But then the Bory had to be sunk herself, and Neil and his ship, the Goff, were a big part of that, as he told us. He didn't tell us that that action would earn the Goff the Presidential Unit Citation. The second destroyer he was on was called the USS Haywood L. Edwards, named for one of the first American casualties of World War II. Lieutenant Commander Haywood L. Edwards had been a heavyweight wrestler on the 1928 U.S. Olympic team, and he was in command of the destroyer USS Reuben James when it was sunk by a German U-boat in the North Atlantic on Halloween 1941, more than a month before Pearl Harbor. Out of a crew of 159, only 44 survived, and Lieutenant Commander Haywood L. Edwards was one of those who perished. Neil had participated in sinking many U-boats. Now he would serve on a ship named for one of the U-boat's victims. And all that duty on the Edwards would be in the Pacific. So how'd you come to serve on that brand new destroyer?
They wanted experienced seamen for the new ships. Our ship was turned into a minesweep, and that's the only shore duty I had, was putting that ship in commission. And that was the only fun part that I can think of in the Navy, putting a new ship in commission. We would go down to Bermuda, shake it down, and turn it, go fast as it'll go and slow as it'll go, and turn it and make sure it was ship shape. Then we formed out to go to the Pacific with some other ships, about 9 ships in a squadron. And we got some from Washington State, and we went through the Panama Canal and went to the Pacific, and I never came back. I never came back even as far as where there was any civilization. Guam was the most civilized place I'd been. I saw an American girl in Guam, and I hadn't seen an American girl in 2 years, you know. So, or any other kind of girl at sea, you don't see very many girls.
Yeah, you guys left Boston for good in April of 44, so the next year and a half or so, I guess, that ship was your only home.
Our first battle was Tinian and Saipan. And Guam, and then from then on, every invasion they had, I was involved in, because I was in that area of the fleet that supported landings, and we would go in the daytime before the troops got there, bomb the island, and retire at sea in the night, and come back in the daytime, and then when the troops came, we would be landing in support, and it would be like watching television. The landing boats would be coming by us, headed for shore, and all the drama and the gunfire aboard. As a matter of fact, Saipan and Tinian was the first really pissed battle we had. And I can remember a story in Saipan. The Japanese had a bonsai attack in the morning, and it drove the troops down on the beach. And we were sitting on, you know, not far from the beach with enough gunpowder to blow the island up. And yet there were so many Japanese soldiers and American soldiers, and the American soldiers were running down towards the water, and the Japanese, we could see them. Get on their knees and shoot the American soldiers. We couldn't shoot back because, but they all swam to a little spit of land out off of the coast, and we sent our small boats over to pick them up. In the people we picked up was a Japanese soldier. They didn't know he was a Japanese soldier, but he'd piled into the boat. I guess he'd seen enough of the war. And he was, as he came alongside, he had his arm over the side of the boat, and I can remember this, and the boat, the waves smashed the boat up against the side of the ship, and he broke his arm. But that was an interesting thing. Saipan was a shocker to us. They had so many suicide, people were committing suicide because they were afraid of the American troops, and they found that we treated them better than the Japanese occupiers did. But
there was so much propaganda from the Japanese. This is one of those famous spots on Saipan, a cliff where all these suicides took place. And these weren't men. These were women and children who'd been told by the Japanese that the Americans would rape and torture them. And you actually witnessed some of that?
I witnessed a lot of it, and I saw the results of it the next, when they jump, their husbands usually would throw the family over the side, or the women would do it, and the mothers and children would land on the beach, and it would, and of course it would kill them, and then the tide would come in that night and wash them all out to sea, and we'd wake up in the morning and see the sea full of bodies in grotesque formations with the children. It was an awesome sight. It was so unnecessary, and within two or three days they found out that the Americans weren't the brutal people that they were led to believe they were. So it was a sad, sad place. It wasn't as fierce fighting as we later came into in some of the other islands like Iwo and all of those. The fighting was fierce. We lost more ships, but it was the beginning of what we were to experience later on in the war in the Pacific.
And I can't imagine, just as a human being, to see that kind of thing. And this was massive enough, the bodies in the surf, that you guys actually had to adjust the way you were running your ship so you wouldn't take in any of that water with all these bodies floating in it. As such a young man, I guess at that point you're about 21 maybe, but to see that, to see these children dying as casualties of this war because of what the enemy was telling them, did that anger you? Did it just shock you? Again, how do you look at something like that and figure out what in the world's going on?
There again, you have propaganda. To us at that time, they were just animals. We didn't have any compassion for them at all. We're there to eliminate them, and we did. I remember during the Battle of Surigao Straits when we had we'd sunk a battleship, and it was half blown up, and it was going backwards about 6 or 7 knots, and it was just full of wounded guys, and we had to sink the ship. We shelled it. There was a life raft full of, one of their life boats were full of people, and the captain said, sink the lifeboat. What do? You sink the lifeboat. It's full of wounded Japanese soldiers, and the bodies flew every place right in front of us. And there were 300 or 400 guys swimming in the water. I saw a guy swimming towards our ship, and another Japanese guy came in, and the guy held his head back like this, and the guy cut his throat right below where I was looking. Apparently, it was an officer, and they thought he was going to defect or something, so he allowed himself to be killed. But they didn't even look at us. If they were turned in your direction, they might look up at the ship. If they weren't, they were so trained that they accepted death for the emperor, and really sad thing, really sad thing.
Yeah, they had been brainwashed, I guess you could say, to believe that dying for the emperor was the ultimate honor. But I guess that's one of those scenes that is why so many veterans have told me that war is hell. I mean, is that what it felt like to you at that point, that this is just an awful situation to be in?
It is, and this was all done through propaganda. You know, we're taught to hate them. They were taught to hate us. Can it happen again? Have we solved it? It seems to me that we really haven't. I don't know if it's a solvable thing. The hatred that can be generated by social means, I don't know how that we've escaped it yet. It bothers me that we might get into that same situation where life meant nothing to the Japanese army at that time. They would love to die. They'd bonsai attacks, and we shot down kamikaze planes, and we'd pick up the pilots that were killed, and they'd open up their wallets and find pictures of their family and their wife and their children, and realize then they weren't the animals we thought they were. They were somebody's father, and it takes you aback, takes you aback. And then you see one of our ships come in from Pickett Station with bodies stacked up on the ship and the superstructure all blown up where the plane had hit it. Then you felt different. I mean, you wanted revenge, and we got it.
Yeah, and let's talk about your specific duties on the ship. And I guess we can get into two other things that took you aback, like the moments where you realize, wow, that could have been it for me right there. And you and I wouldn't be sitting here talking. We wouldn't be talking about your daughter or your son or your long career and selling art materials, the great paintings that your wife did, that you have on the walls around here. None of that would have happened. One of those situations, I guess, was you're manning a 5-inch gun or loading a 5-inch gun near Manila, and a bomber was heading straight for your ship.
Well, the you could look around. There were probably 300 enemy planes in the air. and they were all diving on a ship, and it was just impossible. But we were in the long line, and the ships were in automatic, controlled by the device on top of the bridge. And the control officer said, shift to starboard. So we all five guns shifted to starboard, and I was looking through the scope. I'm looking right at a bomber right down on the water, coming right at us. Fire control officer squeezed the trigger, and all five guns went off at once and just blew him out of the water just because he ran into a hail of lead. It was that we were accurately shooting. But that was that was a long line of ships when we went in first to bomb and destroy Manila, actually. And that was, we were the ships that did it then.
And just so everybody understands that, so you're saying those shells, those 5-inch shells, didn't explode. Just the force of their impact knocked him out of the sky. And so that tells me if they had missed, if they hadn't been accurate, then he wouldn't have missed and you wouldn't be here. Am I exaggerating in that?
You're not. The California, we were there protecting the California in our line of ships, and it was hit three times right in front of us. I could throw a baseball and hit it. And right in front of us, it was hit by three kamikaze planes, which they had enough armor that it didn't do that much damage, but the explosion, the engine going through the armor, and the guys were falling over the side, and we couldn't even stop to pick them up. We threw our life rafts over as we went by, but we had minesweepers that came by and picked them up later. But there was just a ship being taken under fire anywhere you looked. They were just everywhere. And we just swung in and then swung out. That was one of their last big, they had lost the fight for the Philippines right after that. I didn't land in Manila or stay there. We went in and bombed it and left. But they took it over so soon after that.
Well, and there really wasn't a significant battle in the Pacific that you missed out on. You saw all of it. And one of the things you saw, and maybe you foreshadowed this a little bit, because you talked about your patriotism and what it felt like to see the American flag flying in some strange spot. And the most famous image of an American flag from throughout World War II was the second flag, as the story goes, atop Mount Suribachi. There's a good story about the first flag and the second flag. The iconic Joe Rosenthal photo of the flag atop Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima, signifying Americans taking over that high ground. You saw that from aboard your ship, the Edwards?
I saw that, and I don't wonder how many guys that are still left would see that. I was on the bridge manning the voice radio when the officer of the deck said, "Look up there." We looked up and we saw the American flag. We're really close into the lobbing shells into the caves. We had Marine people aboard guiding our guns, and we were right up against it, and we were, it was looming right ahead of us. As a matter of fact, the USS Iowa, which was a major battleship, had come in. It was the only time I ever saw them do that. They were blasting the Suribachi with the rest of us, and we looked up and saw that flag going up, and it was the proudest moment of my life, I think. It was, but we hadn't taken it. I found out later that we hadn't completely avoided the enemy. Just a few days before, we were down the island away from the landing trip, and the ship, a sister ship and I, and the ship I was on, had anchored, and we're throwing star shells out every so often to keep the troops down from operating at night. And we started to get underway the next morning, and our sister ship was just here. It ran into a sandbank and grounded. So they were loading the ammunition from the front, taking it to the back of the ship to unload it, and we saw two water spouts come on each side of the ship, and that was when they zeroed in on it. And the next battery hit right in the ammunition that they were loading, that hit right in the ammunition. And I'm sitting there watching it. I mean, this is, and suddenly the front of the ship just disappeared, and all the guys were on it. It just blew it right up.
And you mentioned seeing that flag, and we all see the photo in black and white, but you saw it in living color. What did that mean to you? Is that one of those moments where you get goosebumps, where you feel that energy, and why?
Well, I don't think that it meant. We realized then that it would mean as much to the world and to the Americans as it did then. It was meant to us that we had, we'd accomplished something on that island that was memorable, that we'd remember forever, but I don't think we had the scope of the thing that was to be of that particular act. But it was just one of the many things that we saw, acts of bravery committed by other people, and we were really proud, but it didn't have the same scope that it does now.
Yeah, I don't think anyone knew at the time how inescapable that image would be for the rest of history. And maybe if we can get you on an honor flight to Washington, D.C. to see the World War II Memorial, you can see the big bronze sculpture of those Marines hoisting the flag above Mount Suribachi at the Marine Corps Memorial. It is a larger-than-life depiction of a legendary moment that you yourself witnessed from aboard your destroyer. And that destroyer wasn't done. Iwo Jima, just the sixth of the seven battle stars it earned. You were on it from the very beginning. And we'll get the rest of Neil Green's World War II story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up, and I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Sito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just gotta go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.